In May of 1977, when the present Knesset was elected, the present government of Israel, nearly 80% of the registered voters went to the polls and cast their ballot. The actual figure was 79.3%. And this number compares favorably to the 52.3% of the American people that exercised their franchise in November of 1980. These figures are interesting, not simply because what they tell about the level of political interest in Israel, but because they suggest that so much of the punditing about why Americans don't vote may in fact be misguided, misdirected. Americans who have written about our campaigns and our political activities have suggested that more Americans are not voting each year in part because we no longer feel bound up to one or another of the political parties, and in part because we are increasingly dismayed by the world of politics and we increasingly despair of politicians. But when you look at Israel, you find the same tendencies at work. 30% of the electorate paid nominal dues to one or another of the political parties of Israel in 1970. And by 1980, that number was halved. Less than 15% of the population declared themselves to be a member of one or another party. And every one of the public opinion polls which have been taken in recent months in Israel suggests that the degree of disenchantment in politics and politicians is at least as great, if not greater, than the spirit, the attitudes of the American people. What then explains this difference in the franchise? Well, I would suggest that voting is a habit. It's a habit that the American people have really never exercised in national elections. In Israel, there has never been an election in the nine that have been held since the state was established when less than 78% of the population that was could go to the polls went to the polls. In the United States, in the last century and a half, there has never been a national election when as many as 70% of the voters went to the polls. In part, it has to do with the meaning of a vote. Americans have always had the vote. We tend to take it for granted. Most Israelis have never had the vote, at least never until they came to Israel. The first time Israelis, most Israelis, could vote was during the late 19th century when they could buy a shekel and vote in campaigns to elect representatives to the World Zionist Congress. And the Israelis got into the habit of thinking of the vote as a statement of national affirmation. It was a way of saying, we're going to take the future into our own hands. We're going to have something to say about our destiny. And I suspect that deep down in the Israeli soul, the voting still has that psychological and emotional impact. It's a way of expressing one's faith in one's ability to control one's destiny. Attitudes in Israel towards politics and politicians are very similar to those in the United States. The magazine Yediot Ahronot, about 2 months ago, took a poll, not like the polls that were taken during the summer when Mr. Reagan and Mr. Carter had become the presidential candidates for the fall. And it was discovered that if one separated out Mr. Perez and Mr. Begin and asked the Israeli electorate to choose between them, just as in September and October, neither of the above won most of those public relations polls, neither of the above is Israel's favorite candidate. Now, when the Israelis go to the polls in June of this year, on June 30th of this year, they will be exercising their national franchise for the 10th time in their history. As you know, they elect not a president, not a prime minister, but a Knesset, 120 members of the unicameral Israeli parliament. And then the party which wins a majority of the seats in the Knesset, or the party which is the major party in the coalition, which can organize a majority of the members of the Knesset, nominates a prime minister and a set of ministers, and these form the government. Israel's government follows largely on the British parliamentary model. So that when the Israelis go to the polls in June, they will enter a polling booth which is quite different from the one with which we're familiar. When we go behind the little curtain, we find ourselves facing a machine with long rows of tape which indicate the various offices which are being contested. And below, next to levers, there are the names of the candidates for these offices, and we press one of these levers to indicate our choice of individual for that particular office. When the Israelis enter their polls, they register and they're given an envelope. And they walk into a polling booth, which is really simply a shelf with little pigeonholes. And on that shelf, there are bundles of ballots. Oh, they're little 3x5 cards, really. Different colors, each imprinted with the motto and the name of one of the 20 or so national parties which are contesting the election. And the Israeli will simply select a ballot from one of those 20 or so bundles, place the ballot in his envelope, seal the envelope, and drop the envelope in the election box. And then the envelopes are opened, the ballots are counted. The total number of votes cast are divided by 120, and each party receives the number of seats in the Knesset, or is allotted the number of seats in the Knesset, equal to the percentage of vote that it receives nationally. And the parties indicate the man or woman that they will select as prime minister by nominating that person as number one on their list of candidates. And they will have 20 or 120 candidates listed by number. And the elections officials will certify the number of candidates, not the individuals, and they will then draw a line at 19 or 23 or 34, and all those who qualify in that list are members of the parliament. The Israelis vote for a party rather than, as we do, for an individual, for people. And this, of course, is a product of their history. In the Middle East, government has largely been by millet communities. Tribes, extended families, selected a member, and he would have some representation at the court, and he would be at the court as representative of his particular group. And when Britain ruled Palestine during the Mandatory Period, Britain allowed the pioneers, the Yishuv, to organize themselves by ideological community. And so there was a socialist ideological community which had its own settlements, which had its own school system, which had its own court system, which even had its own army. And there was an urban, more liberal, economically liberal community which had its own communities, which had its own representatives, which had its own school system. There was the religious community which had its own settlements and its own courts and its own school system. And these ideologically based parties became the basis of the political system of Israel when the state emerged from the pioneering community. And until quite recently, these ideologically based parties contested the elections. And arrangements were always very difficult in Israel because no party was ever able to command an absolute majority of the seats in the Knesset. And so there always had to be a coalition. And the coalition was of the major party, which until 1977 was always Labor, Mapai, and the religious bloc, the National Religious Party and the Aguda, were almost always enough to give Labor the 61 seats it required and a few more. And the religious parties were therefore, though they are small in number, they've never been able to command more than 10% of the national vote. They were always able to secure for themselves that control over the laws of personal status, over the lives of individuals as far as marriage, divorce, adoption, inheritance, kashrut in restaurants and hotels and the like, which they insisted upon. So Israel has had coalition governments, it has had ideologically based governments, and it's had a free, democratic, elected government. Whenever we think of elections, it's well to remind ourselves that the vote, an election, does not by itself prove that a country is democratic. The Soviet Union has elections. There are elections and there are plebiscites. There are elections and then there are referendums of the bureaucracy's power. There are countries like Israel in which 22 parties can contest the election, in which there are no limits as to which parties can stand for election. The Arabs can be in the parliament, the Druzes can be in the parliament, the Communist Party can have members of the Knesset. The only requirement in Israel for the right to stand for election is that you have $250 for a deposit and that you can gain the signatures of 750 qualified voters. That's not hard. They're trying this year to raise the number of signatures required to 1,500. But when you consider the fact that to be elected a municipal judge in one of our local communities, you really need almost that number of signatures, you recognize that there are really no limits on those small groups who would like to have representation in Israel's society. If an election does not by itself establish the democratic nature of a society, what does? I would suggest to you that there are several elements which comprise a democracy. Freedom of speech, freedom to assume responsibility, the ability of the society to transfer power peacefully without revolution, and most of all, a recognition that those in power do not have untrammeled, unlimited authority. That there is a constitution, there is a basic law, there is a compact voluntarily entered into by the community which limits the powers of the king, of the sheikh, of the president, of the prime minister, of the administrative branch of the government. And here it's interesting when we look back into our history to recognize that biblical Jewry, ancient Israel, was in fact the first constitutional state ever devised by man. Before the children of Israel entered into the promised land, according to the founding history, at Mount Sinai, they entered into a covenant not unlike the Mayflower Compact, not unlike our own constitution, a basic law, which we know was affirmed and amended from time to time by covenant renewal ceremonies among the several tribes, who were called Kol Yisrael, the assembly of the tribes, which no one had the right to amend, except God himself in consonance with the tribes of these assemblies, and no individual had the right to transgress or to violate that law. I read to you this morning from the 17th chapter of Deuteronomy, from the Shtar HaMalchut, from the Magna Carta of ancient Israel. If you must have a king, have a king. But the king has no divine rights. He may not legislate basic constitutional law. He may not amend the Torah. He may not multiply his taxes or his harem or sell Israelis as slaves to Egypt in order to get the money to buy armaments. And more than that, as a symbolic act, he is to write out by hand his own Sefer Torah, his own constitution, the basic law, and to keep it beside him and to have it read to him from time to time, as a reminder that he is the administrator of this law, but not its maker. If you look at the ancient stele of Hammurabi and some of the other great emperors of the Middle East, you find that great figure of the seated king announcing the law on his own. The king establishes by fiat the fundamental law of the state. In Israel, it's always Ko Amar Adonai, God establishes the law. No king, no priest, no theocrat, no one has the right to establish that law once it is in being, to create other law or to violate the law. And when a king violated the law, one of the prophets of God would come and symbolically point the finger at him and accuse him of that violation. The theory of the divine right of kings, which was so important in medieval Europe, has no basis in Torah, in our Judaic tradition. Judaism breathes a democratic spirit. And it's interesting to see that almost all of the democracies of the world as they have emerged have followed this prototype from biblical days. A fundamental constitution entered into voluntarily by the community. Israel says at Sinai, Na'aseh v'nishma, we will listen and we will obey. Affirmed by the community. And then no one within the community has the right to violate, to go beyond, to exceed its terms. And so when the Israelis in June, for the 10th time, go to the polls in a national election, they're participating in something which is fundamentally very Jewish, the franchise. And those whom they elect will be limited by the basic law of Israel, limited by constitutional provision. They will not have the authority to do whatever it is they feel right to do, proper to do, desiring to do, simply because they find it desirable, propitious, advantageous to do so. Israel is the only democracy in the Middle East, not because it's the only country in the Middle East which has elections. Egypt has elections, Lebanon has elections, Syria has elections, Iraq has elections, but because in Israel, any group can stand in the elections. People of any persuasion can be elected and take their seats in the parliament. And once elected, no one may exceed the constitutional authority represented by his or her office. Now, what will happen when Israel goes to the polls in June of this year? I'm not a prophet, but I would suggest that very much what happened in November in 1980 in the United States will happen in June of 1981 in Israel. The social scientists describe elections under three categories. They say that there are some elections which are simply maintaining elections. That is, elections where the party in power receives a mandate to continue in power. For 8 successive elections in Israel, the Labor Party received a mandate to continue in office. It was only in 1977 that Menachem Begin and Likud overthrew this long familiar pattern of labor rule. That's a maintaining election, when a president succeeds himself, or when after 2 terms in office, a member of his own party representing the same essential political views rises to that office. And then the social scientists say there's a second kind of election, which is a deviating election. They would describe the election in which Senator McGovern ran for office as a deviating election, the one when Senator Goldwater ran for office as a deviating election. These are elections where, because of some single issue, the traditional voting patterns are askew. They're not followed that particular time, but once that issue is resolved, once someone who is feared because of his extreme aggressiveness or extreme pacifism is no longer the candidate for office, the familiar party alignments reassert themselves, and the country goes on much as it has been before. And the third kind of election, which the social scientist describes, what they call a realignment, a realigning election. This is an election like 1932 in the United States, an election in which there is an almost irreversible change in the political order of things. A new majority coalition emerges, and what has been before no longer has relevance. After 12 years of Republican rule, a new Democratic coalition emerges, which will essentially govern the United States for almost 3 decades. Now, 1977 in Israel represented, I believe, a realigning election. It was an election which repudiated the old labor governing coalition. If you can recall the events which led to the election in 1977, you recall that Israel went through its own Watergate. That is, in the Labor Party, the man who was being nominated for head of the Bank of Israel was convicted of accepting bribes. The man who was the Minister of Housing and Contracts committed suicide while he was in office. The man who was standing for Prime Minister in the Labor Party, Mr. Rabin, was found that he and his wife had illegal bank accounts outside of Israel. Abba Iban, who was standing as foreign minister, potential foreign minister, was found not to have gotten certain kinds of authorization to receive monies outside of Israel. There were a series of scandals. There was a growing sense that the Labor had been in power so long that the Pakidim officialdom was no longer responsive to the community, that there was a set of bureaucrats who had established their own reasons for being, their own sense of authority, and they were increasingly distant from the community. There was an inflation of running at about 30% at the time, which Labor seemed to be unable or unwilling to confront. There was a feeling that Labor's ideology was standing in the way of the introduction of foreign investment in Israel, which the economy desperately needed. And there was also the feeling that the relationship between Labor and the army, which had led to the uncertain victory of 1973, that the state of preparedness was not what it should be, that a new broom, a new form of leadership was needed. And if you remember that election, the old Herut party, the old expansionist party of the Irgun days of Menachem Begin, put together a coalition which spoke to a number of groups which had heretofore been part of the labor alignment. The Oriental Jews of the cities, particularly the poor Jews, whom the Socialist Party, in a sense, was designed to, should have been designed to support, and the intellectual, the academic, the cultural leadership of Israel, who became coalesced in what was called the Movement for Democratic Change, a party led by Yigael Yadin, the famous archaeologist and teacher. A movement which brought together the best of the intellectual elite of the country. These groups, which had up to that time supported the labor alignment, moved away from it and joined into Likud, into the coalition, which Begin put together, which ruled Israel since 1977. And those who have studied the election of 1977 point to the fact that certain fundamental changes are apparent in the community, which will, they believe, forever after, or at least for the foreseeable future, have an important impact on Israeli elections. The first is the end of ideology, the end of party. That sounds like the United States, so be it. The old ideological systems no longer seem relevant to the problems of the state, which are concrete, which are real. Massive inflation, a terrible defense budget, the inability to come to agreement with one's neighbors, the uncertainty about one's relationships to an oil-dependent world, the importance of increasing exports to a world which is increasingly uncertain of the basis of its relationships with Israel, the importance of dealing with the problem of yirida, of brain drain, of the increasing number of Israelis who find greater opportunities outside the state than within. Now, 1977, for the first time in Israel's history, Likud put together a coalition whose ministers were comprised largely of native-born and of Oriental-born. All other parliaments and governments had included a majority of those who had been born in Europe or in America, who had been born in the West. In other words, one of the major shifts which was taking place in Israel, signaled by the 1977 election, was the emergence of a new majority in Israel, the Oriental majority, and the emergence, increasing emergence of the youth of Israel, the native-born, the dominance of those with whom we in the West have the closest affiliation, who speak our language because they come from us, they are of us. That relation, those people are increasingly a minority in the community. And Mr. Begin's government, for the first time in the history of Israeli politics, included a majority of those who were native-born or Oriental, not a majority of European-born or Western-cultured. The second thing that emerged was the growing importance of the city. 80% of Israel's voters now live in urban environments. The kibbutz, the moshav, these agricultural settlements, which are heavily ideological, where the people live closely together, where the sense of party cohesion is the strongest, represent an increasingly small minority of the Israeli community. The city is like our city. It's a place of meeting. It's a place of rubbing of shoulders. It's a place where we get along together, where we may have our private feelings about things, but where the old sense of a community a community bound together by a shared commitment to a religion or an ideology or some economic theory, these no longer are the dominant ties of an urban society. And so the ideological base of the political order has diminished, and the city has become the increasingly dominant element in the Israeli electoral system. Now, according to Israeli law, a campaign must run for at least 100 days. And that's why once Yigal Hurwitz, the finance minister, resigned and took out from the coalition his Rafi party members, and Mr. Begin no longer had a majority of the seats in the Knesset in his coalition, it was necessary to call an election sometime after the 15th of May and before the end of July. The date of June 30th was a compromise date. Mr. Begin wanted to be able to say that his government had stayed in office one day longer than any other government in the history of the state, and so June 30th rather than June 29th or June 28th. It's a long election. Like all elections today, it's a terribly costly undertaking. But unlike the American election, there's a sense of community to it, of naturalness to it. And I suspect this goes back to the question which I raised at the beginning, why so many Israelis vote compared to the number of Americans who vote. For us, presidential candidates are for the largest part figures which we see on the television screen. They're like actors, hidden behind phalanxes of speechwriters and Secret Service personnel. We're really not interested in them as human. We can't touch them, we can't feel them, we can't sense them as human beings. And therefore, we're not that caught up in their private concerns, their private ambitions, or even their private programs. Almost all Israelis, after all, it's a small society, there are 2.25 million voters, potential voters in Israel. Almost all Israelis have been in the same room with all of the major candidates for office. They've listened to them speak as we're speaking together today. They've sensed them as human beings. And so they are caught up to a certain degree with their fate and their future and their personalities. They do care. There's that sense to Israel. But unfortunately, one of the things that Israel seems to be borrowing from the West is the use of the media, television blitzes, canned speeches, professional speech writers, all those other artificial phenomena by which we create our artificial candidates and then vote for candidates who seem to reflect what we know are our opinions in the first place. And that too is going to create a greater sense of distance. But I think in Israel today, given the fact that they had a realignment campaign election 4 years ago, what you're going to see is an election which repudiates Mr. Begin. Mr. Begin stands to Israel the way Mr. Carter stood to these United States. He's respected as a human being. He's accepted as a fine religious man. It's however felt that he is incapable, unable to administer a government effectively, that he changes his mind quite often, that he has surrounded himself with a small coterie of yes people, and has walled himself away from the powers in the Knesset and from others who are important in the government. And there's one element in the Israeli relationship to Mr. Begin which was not in our relationship to Mr. Carter, and that he is old and he is sick, and he has had several minor attacks while he has been in office, and there's a great fear he lacks the energy, the psychic energy, to concentrate on the problems of government. But of course, all elections are ultimately decided on the pocketbook. And in Israel, the problem is inflation. And he came to office when inflation was running in the 30% range. And he's leaving office with inflation running in the 130% range. And no one who stands on such a record can ultimately be reelected. But Mr. Begin will be reelected. He will be number one on the list of his party. And his party will receive 20 or 25 seats in the new Knesset. The public opinion polls, which have been taken recently in Israel, suggest that there will be a great victory for Labor. What they're really measuring is that there's a great antipathy to the continuance in office of the Likud, Mr. Begin's government. And I'm not at all convinced that as we follow this election, we're going to see any great groundswell of feeling in Israel that labor deserves to come into office, that it has a mandate, that it has answers to the problems which face the nation. After all, labor was voted out 4 years ago precisely because it didn't have answers. And the same people who led labor 4 years ago are leading labor today. And they have not essentially changed their position. And their inability to relate to the Sephardic community, their inability to relate to the problem of Yeridah, their inability to have a program which could really deal with inflation, all of these things are evident to the Israeli electorate. It's really that despite the 22 or more groups who will contest the election, there's really no one who has come up with a program which can galvanize the nation. What I suspect you're likely to see in the ensuing months is not so much a great outpouring for labor. Some are even saying that for the first time in Israel's history, one party, labor in this case, will receive an absolute majority of the parliament. I doubt that. I think what you're going to see in the next months is the emergence of a number of parties which you haven't heard of before. The intellectual leadership of Israel who formed the Movement for Democratic Change were disappointed by those who led the Movement for Democratic Change, but they're still there. And they still want electoral reform, and they still want more democracy, they want a greater sensitivity to the problem of the Arab in Israel, they want more concern for the quality of life in Israel. They'll form some kind of party around some kind of new leadership. And those who have gone out into the West Bank, the Gush Emunim, those we've heard about so much as the band of the faithful, those who represent a kind of old line nationalism, convinced that the days of the Messiah are at hand, that Israel must make no compromises with the Arab world, they too will form some kind of party. It'll have deep roots in the Sephardic community. It'll have deep roots in the religious community. It will appeal to many who are frustrated by Israel's position in the world and the oily conscience of the world. And they too will form some kind of coalition, and they too will get a sizable number of votes in the national election. It's going to be a bitterly contested election. It's going to be an election where there will be, as in the last election here in the United States, no real issues. It'll be more a matter of approach. Foreign policy will be much debated. But I want you to recognize as you read the papers that there is very little difference between the foreign policy of Mr. Begin's government and the foreign policy of a Labor government. Neither will move an inch on Jerusalem. Neither is willing to give absolute sovereignty to an Arab state, a PLO state in the West Bank and Gaza. The Labor Party speaks of what they call a Jordanian option, which is simply the idea that Jordan should have some kind of hegemony over the West Bank, but not troops in the West Bank. They would rather see Jordan than the PLO. But Israeli troops will still occupy the strategic centers of the West Bank, and Israeli settlements will still be on the West Bank. There's really a difference between that and the so-called autonomy which Mr. Begin has proposed. And no government in Israel can budge an inch on Jerusalem. So there's really very little difference. There'll be different actors, but the sense of the community will not change a great deal in that area. Nor will it really change a great deal in the area of economics, because inflation, as we're discovering in the United States, is not an easily curable problem. Mr. Reagan promised us a quick fix, and he was going to balance the budget when in June in 1982, and in December in 1983, and now in February in 1984, and by June it'll be 1985, and by the time he runs for re-election, it'll be 1990. Inflation is endemic in the economies of the West. Israel has indexed its economy so that some of the burden of inflation that we might feel has not been felt as brutally. The problems of Israel are the problems of defense. They're connected intimately to the questions of foreign policy. So that no government is really going to be able to solve in a major way this basic problem of the social order. The Israelis will go to the polls and exercise their democratic franchise, and when they do, they'll be the one country in the Middle East which continues in a democratic tradition. And when they do, they will be voting for a system, as part of a system which is a system in transition from ideological politics to party politics, more personality-based politics, the kind of politics we're more used to in these United States. I think it would be well for all of us to recognize that just as most elections in this country do not really change the basic way in which the society is organized or administered, the same will happen in Israel. I'm concerned by the fact that I hear people who say that they expect great changes. They're dissatisfied with Mr. Begin. They think of the Labor Party, Mr. Peres, or any others as people who will do what they think ought to be done. No politician can do more than what the society which elects him permits him to do. He can't get that far beyond the popular will. And the popular will in Israel, and I close with this, is not peace at any price, but it's peace, responsible peace within secure borders. It's peace which includes Jerusalem as the capital of the state. It's peace which includes the proposition that the West Bank, Judah and Samaria cannot be Judenrein, cannot be the only place on the face of this earth where Jews are not allowed to settle. These are basic, fundamental positions agreed upon by the majority of the Israeli population. No government that comes into power will be able to go beyond that, those basic statements. And those of in America, Jews and otherwise, who would like to see, for American reasons or their own reasons, some change in this basic position, are going to be disappointed. Israel will choose those people and those parties which will meet the needs of their population. Their needs are housing, economic, welfare, and defense. That's the basis of any election. It was the basis of ours. And we can only hope that the people whom they elect will be responsible, and we can only agree that in our understanding of Israel, that it is broad enough to include the right of the Israelis to select those leaders who support the needs and goals and aspirations of their people. The ultimate test of the community of Israel is the recognition that Israel's decisions must, in the first instance, be Israel's, and not the needs, the public relation needs of the diaspora communities. Amen.